Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. On this International Women's Day, we'll be joined by three women covering very different subjects. We'll begin with Reem Khalifa, who is the Senior Editor for Diplomatic Affairs at Al-Wasat, the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, where demonstrations continue against the ruling family, although the attention of the world's press has shifted to Libya. Then we will look into what seems to be spy versus spy in Pakistan, where an imprisoned American CIA contractor, Raymond Davis, might well have been the target of an attempted kidnapping by Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. Christine Fair, a leading specialist on Pakistan, joins us to look into the possibility of spy wars among allies. Then finally, we will discuss the state and status of women and the Republican assault on women's rights with feminist activist Frances Kissling, who is a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And a reminder that this program and previous ones are available at ianmasters.com, where I also do a daily blog. And today's essay is called Women and Children First, Into Poverty. So click on blog at ianmasters.com and let me know what you think. Now let's go to Manama, Bahrain. I'm speaking with Reem Khalifa, who is the senior editor for diplomatic affairs at Al-Wasat in Bahrain. And clearly, Reem Khalifa, Bahrain has receded from the headlines largely because of what is going on in Libya. But that doesn't mean that there are not a lot of political activity. Last Friday, 100,000 protesters descended on the streets of Manama, and many of the signs what they were carrying say, revolution, the only solution. So give us an update, if you will.
Well, so far today, we had a number of march coming out from the Pearl Square in the middle of Manama. And they were like marching, heading to the Bahrain Financial Harbor. And the majority of them were women, actually. It was like a sign to show celebration for Women's Day today. There were all kinds of Bahraini women, liberals, conservative, Islamists, all kind. And they were carrying slogans saying, calling for to fall the regime or the resignation of the government. So as we have two groups calling for different demands, and so far there is a group of movements from the opposition announced today that they calling for a republic and the fall for the monarchy constitution, since we never really had one since the Bahraini people voted on the referendum 10 years ago on the National Action Charter, which transformed the Bahrain to a constitutional kingdom. But what happened so far that we see different voices as well coming up and appearing with, with the sectarian way. I mean, like, since we do have only a state TV, one, you know, state TV station and a radio station, which is also owned by the government, that the way how they promote the issue in Bahrain, it is always one-sided, one view, and it's always it looks like more sectarian that presenting the other group in a different way, which upsets majority of Bahraini, even among the Sunnis or even the Shia. The hardliners actually in both sides are taking advantage so far. This is how we are observing. And we see, for example, the seven opposition societies are more focusing on the demands when it comes on the resignation of the government and by having an elected government and a new prime minister, because our prime minister been in power for 40 years. And, what's happening right now, even to have a new constitution, this includes and releasing political prisoners, free press, etc. So the thing is basically, with a lot of things happening right now in Bahrain, yes, it is a revolution, it is a movement. Young people in this country are very much inspired with the Tunisian and the Egyptian revolutions. The demands are not new demands. It's always been there for almost 30 years. And probably what happened in Tunisia encouraged these young people to come and to have the initiative to move and to select a point in the capital of Manama. which is actually, it's a roundabout, but it's a main roundabout in Bahrain for all the areas. So they consider it like their square, and they named it a prayer square because even this is the place which represents the symbol of the unity of the Gulf states in the region. And Bahrain is the prayer, as in Bahrain, it's an island in the middle in the Gulf. So basically, what we see right now, it's the mood of the street. It is, driven by those young people. And what they want change and justice and freedom. And when you ask them, they keep saying these three words. And plus, they keep telling you, we want a civil elected government. It doesn't matter how it looks like, but we want something civil. And what we are calling, it's completely peacefully, as long we are carrying our flags and protesting peacefully, and until the government either resign or we change the regime.
And Reem Khalifa, the king, Hamid al-Khalifa, he's met recently with the President Obama's National Security Advisor, Thomas Danilon. And I understand that a lot of the protesters in the street feel that the United States isn't behind their fight for democracy, as they were somewhat belatedly behind the Egyptians and now, of course, are opposed to Gaddafi. In the case of the Egyptian revolution, Mubarak kept bringing up the specter of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, Gaddafi is bringing up the specter of al-Qaeda. I take it in Bahrain, the royal family are trying to drive a wedge between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority. Is that right?
Well, unfortunately, I'll take from the last part. The last part, unfortunately, we do have, a member of the family, let's describe them, the hardliners, who's supporting even the Sunni hardliners, who could be some of them even pro-Al-Qaeda, or they have neighboring, agenda. And this kind, which upsetting some of the neighboring countries in the region, and this kind of thing, we can pretty very much, obviously, we can feel it because even this, what happening right now is after the fail of the military and the security papers. Now they're playing with the sectarian paper, and that's why you can't really open a national dialogue if your TV, the government TV, is spreading hate, sectarian, promoting issues which is making or describing a group of ethnic group in the country with names and with things that's really racist terminology and discrimination. This is not acceptable. Plus, since I'm a journalist, I'm an independent journalist, and my newspaper is the only independent newspaper in Bahrain. And because we are trying to be in between and independent, it's very, very much hard. And that's why some group of these people, they made like a table that describing, journalists like me and others with names or agents or whatever, spreading rumors. So this kind, not just our profession in the media, but also doctors, engineers, in each ministry in Bahrain, if you are not with us, then you're against us. Then you will be in this table. This is basically similar to the idea of terrorist tables, it's just something really unbelievable. I have to update you right now. We have an area which is overpopulated with Sunnis in Busaytin and Muharraq. Now we have, they had this morning, a number of incidents, clashes with the, number of Bahraini Shias who were not really protesting or something. And they were beating up with people saying they are Sunni, but they look like thugs carrying swords and knives. And right now they say, according to our correspondent, that so far there is like a massive number of security forces and riot police around the area. The reason why this area also been very much targeted because we had a very strange incident happen in the front of the Bahrain Financial Harbor when a young Bahraini lady, she was driving her car and she passed near the peaceful protest in the front of the harbor. And then she stopped her car and she spit on two of the protesters. And then she went back to her car after they start kicking her car, and then she hit two protesters and they were injured with minor injuries. What I'm trying to say, all this happening because there is too much hate becoming in society, while the demands that the people calling for, it's absolutely a human demand, according to many opposition figures, and even for any ordinary Bahrainis, or even for the National Coalition initiative, which was announced just a few weeks ago. They're all calling for these demands because this government is full with blood and they abuse a lot of Bahrainis, and there is a lot of human rights records. That's the thing. Now, when it comes with the American position, Bahrainis were very much happy to see President Barack Obama standing beside the people by saying they have the right to protest peacefully. It's the same announcement he made for our neighboring countries to Saudi Arabia. I mean, this kind of thing is always, we had a problem with the authorities here, even for the reporters when they go undercover, because, you know, this definition doesn't exist, you know. They will always hit these demos, no matter what. But recently, since the announcement made by President Obama, things became better and people started to increase more their protests in a critical locations like, you know, Dar al-Hukuma, where the prime minister office, the parliament, the weekly ministry meeting held in the palace, etc. So it's all located in the capital of Manama. Now, lately, what it came by Mr. Jeffrey Feltman, that, you know, they have to start the national dialogue without conditions and should be, you know, they should compromise. I mean, this would never happen with the Bahraini case. We all believe that as a Bahraini and as a journalist, the way how I see things, the dialogue can be happening as long if we see the government is serious about having this dialogue with everybody and compromising, because these demands, first of all, is very old demands. Secondly, the state TV has to stop spreading hate and insulting a majority group of Bahrainis, which we are living with them. I am Sunni, and I respect my brother Shia, and I know we are minorities, and there are minorities also from other religions, like Christians, Jews, Baha'is, Hindu, and we always live together in harmony with other religions or sects. Bahraini are very good, you know, example in the region when it comes for tolerance. We never really experience having a violence or to have thugs. The way how we see things happening now, dividing society through sectarian issues or by saying don't go to that area, that's a very, very, very dangerous thing, because having this kind of mentality, that means they're not really serious to have this nice national dialogue. And sure, that's what made Bahrain's protest yesterday at the U.S. Embassy, trying to tell them stop, supporting a dictatorship government.
Well, let me ask you again. I'm speaking with Reem Khalifa, who is the senior editor for diplomatic affairs at Al Wasat, which is the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, and we're talking to her in Manama. And obviously, the United States is concerned about the future of the base for the U.S. Fifth Fleet there in Bahrain. What do you understand, Reem, that the protesters feel about this base? Are the U.S. fears of losing this base justified?
You see, I have to tell you, The protests, they don't really fear having the base in Bahrain. Why? Because they even really experience seeing Americans coming to the square, offering help, you know, having tea with them and joining some of the activities that's going on in the square. And, you know, Bahrain's never had a problem having the American base or even having American among them. And that's why you see the opposition, and especially not the liberal ones, but, I mean, let's say all of them, they agreed, including the Shia Islamists, which is represented by Al-Wifaq National Islamic Society, that they made a very clear statement that they want an elected civil government, and they don't want anything to be changed, you know. And they mentioned this with the Americans or with other, you know, friendship with other neighboring countries or from other parts of the world. And they were very clear about this. And when it comes with other groups, the hardliners, both sides hardliners, I can tell maybe the other one who's against to see the base or the American existence in Bahrain. But this is obviously, it comes to, because they have a sort of agenda, as everybody knows what is the sort of agenda in the region towards the American existence in the Gulf. But generally speaking, it's what's happening right now. It needs a big push from everybody to understand what's happening in Bahrain. It could be solved easily if the governor decided to compromise. This will give an end. But if nobody really compromised, then I think it will lead to a worse scenario that we don't hope that to happen, because so far what we hear until now, it looks like they want to lead to a civil war just to stay in power. And this is not acceptable. And this what even we hear things happening in our region with neighboring countries. And they have to understand that time for change, you know, it's appeared now. It's you know, mm-hmm. people are very much fed up with promises and lies. And this is what most protesters, they keep saying to us, and keep saying even in addressing their speeches in the square or even in the slogans. And one more thing, they keep telling Bahrainis, Shia, go back to Iran. I mean, if you talk to them, they say we are fed up with this story because the indigenous of this island is the Arab Shia, and there are Arab tribes. And the mm-hmm. people, the Shia from Iranian origins are minorities, by the way. Sure. And the Sunnis are immigrants. So if we will go for that, that means all the Sunni immigrants, they need to get out of this island. It doesn't make any sense, sure. you know, when they sure. talk like this.
Well, Reema, I'm afraid we're running out of time, and there's just one last question I need to ask. So if you don't mind, just give me a quick answer here. My understanding, and you alluded to this, that Saudi Arabia is influencing and their special forces were behind the massacre that happened in Manama recently, and that the king, Hamid of Bahrain, may well want to moderate and do the things that you're expecting, but the Saudis are the ones that are pushing the hard line. Is that true?
Well, It could be. This is what we are hearing. As I said to you, in the Gulf, you have to know that there are some, you know, hardliners or, let's say, fanatic members of the royalties who wouldn't really like to see any change or any democratic system. You know, the people in the region happy to have the relation with the Americans because it's always been there, especially when it comes to Bahrain. So, as long you have, I mean, you deal with a real democratic system, that you know, which you know, when I asked to with the head of WAG Society, Ibrahim Sharif, the Liberal Society, he was telling me yesterday, you know, the Americans, they have elected government more than 230 years. Why we can't have? Why they stop us to have, you know, the opportunity? They said we have a great opportunity. Why we can't have this opportunity by having a proper government like everybody. We're not asking much. These are human principles, and the principles that the opposition and the protest calling for is something that everybody called for it. But because after the massacre, what happened, and there was like a blood, and plus after the speech, which was delivered by the king himself and by the Minister of Interior, and then people witnessed this massacre, then they were obviously shocked, you know, because passing a condolences, and then the other day they witnessed a massacre. That was a big shock for many Bahrainis, you know, who experienced really tough times, and especially with the doctors. And we went through that, and we saw how they stopped the ambulance to come to the square to collect the injured people, and how the main state hospital was in a big mess, and the doctors were protesting because the Minister of Health, the previous one, didn't allow the ambulance cars to go to the square. So this kind of thing, yeah, I mean, it could be neighboring countries, they fear change. They fear that mm-hmm. freedom could happen in this region, justice, different style of system. So, but I have to say, you know, the Gulf region is not really far away from change. How it will happen, I mean, I don't imagine that we could be like the Egyptian or the Tunisian, but obviously maybe the people in this region would really prefer to have something like with a constitutional monarchies as like what we see like in many European countries, like, sure. for example, United Kingdom or Sweden, for example.
Well, sure. Well, Reem Khalifa, we've run out of time here, and I do thank you so much for joining us. I know you stayed up late, and it's been much appreciated by me, and I'm sure by our audience. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Reem Khalifa, who is the senior editor for diplomatic affairs at Al Wasat, the only independent newspaper in Bahrain. And let's now take a brief station break, and I'll be back talking about a spy, a possible reason for the arrest of the American CIA contractor in Pakistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Chris, what do you think is going on with the arrest of Raymond Davis? At this point, we've learned that he's probably a CIA contractor. But there are rumors or suspicions that this may be some kind of spy versus spy situation. We're told that the people that he shot, the two people that he shot, were supposed to be attempting to rob him. But there are some indications that they may have been working for the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI. Is there any information that you have to that effect?
Well, I mean, let's address the first part. I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, the U.S. government has pretty much said that he was a contractor that was working for the CIA. We have subsequently learned that he was doing surveillance and security detail for a safe house in an obscure part of Lahore. And presumably, there are a number of reports that suggest that this cell was specifically dedicated to keeping an eye out upon Lashkar-e-Taiba. Lashkar-e-Taiba is perhaps one of the most lethal terrorist groups in South Asia. Some of your listeners might know of it because that group perpetrated the 2008 massacre that lasted 4 days, of course, in part due to incompetence of Indian security officials that took place over Thanksgiving weekend. So the reason why this would be provocative, of course, is that the Lashkar-e-Taiba, along with a number of groups associated with the Afghan Taliban, as well as the Haqqani network, are assets of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI. So there's no doubt that they would have known about the cell, but there's also no doubt that it really would have discomfited them to know that the CAA was going after one of their most prized proxies.
And do you think that it therefore follows that the orchestration of outrage that is associated with this trial and this arrest, and the fact that one of the victims of the that the CIA operative or contractor shot his widow committed suicide by swallowing rat poison, and apparently there's been substantial demonstrations as a result.
Well, the frustrating thing about that, so the first issue is it is strongly my suspicion. In fact, a very high-level Pakistani official had intimated to me before I went to Pakistan about 3 weeks ago that, in fact, the two fellows that were following him were his, quote, ISI detail. Now, what does that mean, ISI detail? I seriously doubt that the fellows that followed him were, in fact, official ISI, but rather, you know, the ISI, like the CIA, hires contractors of a variety of levels of competence and skill. And I don't doubt for a second, in fact, the reporting has suggested that these guys may have, in fact, have been hired by the ISI either to, A, just sort of ruffle this guy's feather and send a message to the CIA, or even in extrema, anticipated that this guy, being a special operations fellow, a known shooter, may have responded in the way in which he did to a potential menacing threat, thereby bringing about this rupture. With respect to the widow, I think that there is more than meets the eye. I'm forgetting the woman's name, and I'm actually quite Jugnu. She is the wife of the editor and founder of the Daily, Jugnu Mohsen. She is the wife of Najm Sethi. I was on a radio interview with her about 10 days or so ago, and she had actually some very specific information about that suicide. Apparently, it came down to her relationship with her in-laws and what her life would be like with those in-laws, as well as the disposition of that family towards taking money to compensate them for the loss. So this seems to be the suicide seems to be much more germane to the status of that woman within her in-laws. And of course, for anyone that's familiar with South Asia, this is a persistent issue. It's not remotely uncommon for daughter-in-laws upon being widowed to actually commit suicide. It's just that in this particular context, this particular suicide has taken on a particularly intense political salience.
Again, I'm speaking with Georgetown Professor Christine Fair. But of course, this idea that Blackwater and CIA contractors are infiltrating Pakistan came up during the Kerry Lugar bill when it was being offered to Pakistan $7 billion for largely for education and welfare. That prompted a lot of the press in Pakistan, and one assumes that that perhaps the ISI was stoking the nationalistic fires of going on about how the Americans were doing all kinds of nefarious things there. So
you have part of that story correct. The issue with Kerry Lugar Burman that was so objectionable to the military was the very specific conditionalities upon security assistance, which mentioned in very explicit terms the requirement for the Secretary of State to certify that Pakistan, among other things, is making progress in degrading the Afghan Taliban, groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed, and very clearly Pakistan is making no progress along those lines, having progress towards money laundering legislation and progress towards making transparent, without mentioning AQ Khan by name, the network that nonetheless he was in charge of. Now, the Pakistan embassy, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, was very much involved in another important conditionality was that the military not intervene in political affairs. Now, this came out of a longstanding criticism that the United States had disproportionately assisted Pakistan's military regime. And this was largely for historical reasons. From 55 to 65, Pakistan was a Sino-Centro ally. From 79 to 89, Pakistan was central in the anti-Soviet jihad. And obviously from 2001 to now, And particularly for the first 8 years under President Musharraf, Pakistan was an ally of the U.S. in the war on terror. And so these were all periods under which Pakistan was governed by a military dictator. So there was this longstanding criticism that the United States stopped providing assistance when there was return to democracy. So Kerry Lugar Berman was intended to do two things. Basically, it was intended to be a reward for Pakistan's return to democracy. This was actually conceived of in 2008 by Vice President Biden initially, and then it became Kerry Lugar Berman. Then the other issue was that it was to put an incentive in place to keep the military out of the business of the running of the state and to put pressure on the military and intelligence officials to stop engaging in activities which are harmful to the U.S. global war on terror. Those were the issues that the ISI had generated and, quite frankly, manufactured protests about, and it was able to do so because it has a number of media interlocutors, both on television, it's the most vibrant media that the ISI can buy, as well as in print media. But rest assured, everyone knew about this. They chose the timing to manufacture this dissent just as the Kerry Lugar Berman legislation was being rolled out. It had nothing to do with these contractors that was cruising about. It had everything to do with the U.S. conditioning assistance of a military variety upon the very things that the Pakistani state remains dedicated to doing.
No, I meant that was a precursor to set the stage, if you will, in terms of atmospherics. Now that there's a second round of this spurious nationalism being ginned up, and whether or not these guys intended to shoot or kidnap or whatever they were planning on doing to the American, who's now, we're claiming diplomatic immunity, and I guess the judge will rule on that, next week sometime?
Of course, the issue is it's not a judicial issue. This is the drama. I mean, I call this a legal loophole of palooza. This is not a judicial issue. Eventually, the prosecutor is going to ask the foreign officer, did this fellow have diplomatic immunity? And he's going to have to, because it is a he, it's not a she, is going to have to simply reveal his cards that, of course, he has diplomatic immunity. The sending country determines the status of their individuals in the country, not the receiving country. The receiving country only accepts or denies. And this fellow had been in the country for 3 years. He was on a legal visa. It had been renewed on a number of occasions. So the difference is that the Foreign Office, when it finally reveals its hand, it will either be truthful, in which case this whole drama will have been revealed to be nonsensical, or it's going to continue to obfuscate and demur, which will provide further evidence that Pakistan's not a law-bound society.
But what is the motive here? We're in this perpetual dance with Pakistan, where we give the military money, and now with the Kerry Lugar Berman, we give the civilian side money. They don't do what we ask and expect of them. They're aiding and abetting the people who are killing our boys and girls in Afghanistan. We're supposedly there because we're afraid the nukes will fall into the wrong hands. But this dance that goes on, at some point, you wonder whether we can cut bait in frustration and accept the consequences, or why do we continually allow ourselves to be jerked around like this?
Well, okay, so going back to the to the strategic level, what is going on here? This is most definitely a CIA-ISI wrestling match. The problem with Pakistan is that it cannot say, in most forthright terms, that we're not going to stop supporting the Afghan Taliban, we're not going to stop supporting the Haqqani Network, we're not going to stop supporting Lashkar-e-Taiba and those elements of Jaish-e-Mohammed that have not turned against the state. Pakistan cannot say and will not say publicly that we view the Indian threat to be as an existential threat as you view Al-Qaeda. And these organizations are the organizations that we rely upon to deal with India, because we have no diplomatic, military, or other means, political or otherwise, to deal with the Indian threat. They can't say this. And in fact, I've had a number of extremely high-level Pakistani intelligence officials say to me, you know, that we're in a position that we don't like to be in. We need your assistance, but we resent it. And unlike other partners that you have, they can set the terms. They have leverage. He noted the Indian situation where the Americans basically gave the Indians, and he was right, a bomb-friendly civilian nuclear deal because we wanted the deal more than the Indians did. So the problem with the Pakistanis and the Americans is that we need each other, but we need each other for reasons that don't make either of us happy. And the fundamental problem with this mutual dependence is that we have strategic interests that are completely different from one another. And so unlike the India-U.S. relationship, which is proceeding because we have increasingly consonant security interests for the region as well as internationally, our relationship with Pakistan requires constant attention, constant grooming, because our own natural strategic interests are divergent, not convergent.
So in other words, it's not going to get any better, but it could get a lot worse.
There's no question that that's the trajectory that we're presently on. Both countries are currently figuring out, is this partner of ours a partner, albeit sort of a pain in the arse partner, or is this in fact an enemy? We're both asking this. And so my reading of the Raymond Davis affair is that this is really the CIA dealing with the ISI. We have no options. I mean, after Mumbai, the United States understands that Lashkar-e-Taiba is not simply a threat to India, but it's a threat to us. We can't do anything within Pakistan. We can't alter their cost-benefit calculus to knock it off. And so, you know, the CIA, the fact that we have this, you know, potentially a CIA cell hunting Lashkar is a pretty good signal of our desperation to do something. And the Pakistanis are equally adamant to keep Lashkar alive. So at the end of the day, Lashkar-e-Taiba, along with the Afghan Taliban, especially as they're trying to get out of Afghanistan, and groups like the Haqqani Network, there's no way of painting over these very real differences. There's simply no way. So the question is, how do we retain this partnership when our strategic differences are so striking? And as you said, we paid the Pakistanis, you know, like circa $18 billion, whatever the magic number is, overtly, and dog only knows how much covertly, to support the war on terrorism. Yet they're supporting the group, the Afghan Taliban, which is the only group that's killing our troops in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's not killing our troops. There are virtually no Al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. They've all fled to Pakistan. So the American taxpayer, the American government is really wondering, you know, what's going on with this partner of ours? They've taken so much money, yet they have resulted in so many fatalities for us in Afghanistan and elsewhere. But I also want to add very briefly that for the Pakistani citizen, they see a similar toll as a result of their country signing up with us. They have an unprecedented insurgency that has expanded throughout what's now Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and the federally administered tribal areas and has gone deep into provinces like the Punjab. And they don't see this as blowback from their country supporting these various militants. They see this as a direct consequence of this country, of their leadership aligning with us. So these differences are enormous, and they're very difficult. It's just difficult for me to imagine how we overcome them, especially in the wake of the Raymond Davis affair, which has laid all of this naked for all of us to see.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Chris. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Previously, she served as a political officer to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and as a senior research associate at the United States Institute for Peace's Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And she's a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the state of women on this International Women's Day. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And before we go to our next guest, let's just play a clip from a wonderful spoof that Judi Dench does playing M and Daniel Craig does playing 007. Obviously, we can't give you the visuals here, but 007 appears, walks out of the shadows, and then halfway through, he returns dressed as a woman. Let's go to that clip, and then we'll be joined by our guest.
We're equals. Aren't we, 007? Yet it is 2011, and a man is still likely to earn more money than a woman, even one doing the same job. You have a far better chance of entering political office or becoming a company director. As a man, you're less likely to be judged for promiscuous behaviour, which is just as well, frankly, and hardly any chance of falling victim to sexual assault. And unlike the 30,000 women in the UK who lose their jobs annually due to pregnancy, there would be virtually no risk to your career if you chose to become a parent, or became one accidentally. For someone with such a fondness for women, I wonder if you've ever considered what it might be like to be one. The world has changed, but the numbers remain stacked against us. Women are responsible for two-thirds of the work done worldwide, yet earn only 10% of the total income and own 1% of the property. It's not just about money and power. Every year, 70 million girls are deprived of even a basic education, and a staggering 60 million are sexually assaulted on their way to school. We're afraid to walk the streets at night, yet some of us are even more afraid to return to our own homes. At least one in four are victims of domestic violence. And every week, two women in the UK are killed by a current or former partner. So, are we equals? Until the answer is yes, we must never stop asking.
And that was a clip that's available at weareequals.org, which is a charity led by Annie Lennox. And I'm joined by feminist activist Frances Kissling. She was president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She is currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She's a consultant to the Western Hemisphere region of the International Planned Parenthood Foundation, where she works on reproductive health in Latin America. She writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. And on this day, celebrating International Women's Day, let's talk about, you know, give us a little bit of a state of the state of women, given, I think, that it's pretty clear that with this new Congress, there is a right-wing Republican assault on women's rights.
Yes, definitely. I think that the Judi Dench clip is just great in giving a whole lot of statistics, but and certainly the plight of women in the developing world is particularly devastating. But when you look at what's happening in the U.S. today, you realize that we haven't come quite such a long way. You know, when you think that the first bills introduced by Republicans in Congress at a time when the country is falling apart economically and engaged in wars on several fronts, and the Middle East is in turmoil, had to do with abortion and family planning. You can see that we haven't really come as far as we would like to. You have the case of an attempt by Republicans to cut off all of the money in the federal budget for family planning in the United States of America, as well for all poor women, as well as cut off permanently any money that would go to Planned Parenthood, which is, you know, the safety net for poor women. You have an attempt to expand the right of doctors and healthcare workers who are working in emergency rooms and in obstetrical wards in the U.S. by making it no longer a crime for them to permit a woman to die in pregnancy if the thing that would save her life is an abortion. I mean, they can actually just simply turn her away if she is dying for that reason. And you have an attempt to redefine rape as a reason for support. You know, when we're providing funding for there's a very limited number of circumstances under which we can provide funding for women seeking an abortion. One of them traditionally has been rape. But you now have an attempt to close down what Republicans see as the rape loophole by saying that all insurance companies can only pay for an abortion in the case of rape if the rape is something called forcible. So you have this attempt to redefine rape going back, 75 years to a point in which unless you were, held at knife point, you haven't been raped. So you really see some of the most bizarre attitudes towards women reflected in the way the U.S. is attempting to legislate on reproductive rights right now.
But Frances Kissing, I'm under the impression that the Republicans are attacking on two fronts, both at the federal level and the state level,
yes.
And that what's going on in Wisconsin is an example of their attack on the people that the public employees union that fund the Democratic Party, and that even though it's at a state level, as we know from the bogus phone call, the governor is coordinating with other governors. But of course, the first thing the governor did in his budget, if you read the fine print, is zero out Planned Parenthood. My understanding is that the Republicans' strategy is also a statewide strategy to ban abortion at the state level, and now we're learning that the new bill before the Georgia legislature, this anti-abortion bill, would require an investigation of women who had miscarriages.
That's right. You have bills like the Georgia bill that you just described. You have attempts again to increase the use of ultrasound. That women must look at ultrasounds of their pregnancy before having an abortion, which makes the cost rise. You have an attempt in many states to take the Health Care Reform Act, which of course they want to overturn entirely anyway, but to use the Health Care Reform Act to totally ban all insurance companies in states from covering abortion. You have restrictions of abortion in the second trimester abortion going beyond the limits that were set by Roe. So the assault is at both the state and the federal level. And as is often the case, the most dramatic kinds of legislation where women are concerned relate to their reproductive freedoms. But, of course, obviously, when you look at state the attack on state employees, the attack on educators, the attack on teachers, Chris Christie's approach to all of this. The people in those jobs are more often than not women.
So, Frances Kissing, if this continues, we are going to have a new kind of sort of social civil war, if you will, a culture war, where the country is going to be divided, and you will have an America where desperate young women in the red states have to slip past a cordon of Christian vigilantes checking their papers at bus stations so that they can escape to blue states and end pregnancies caused by the lack of contraception and the absence of sex education.
Right.
That sounds like a futuristic movie, but yeah. That future is fast approaching, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, when I was looking at reviewing some of this stuff recently, I was thinking of The Handmaid's Tale, that Margaret Atwood's famous novel in this arena where you are in a tightly controlled society, and historically tightly controlled societies. Non-democratic societies seek first and foremost the two things you do is you take over the radio station and you take over women's reproduction, and that's what we're looking at.
But I would like to get a hand, and you've worked for years and years in this fighting this defensive war, if you will, against this. A perpetual and relentless war on women's rights.
Yeah.
I still don't understand the motivations. I mean,
the
extreme version is that fellow that shot the doctor in his own church.
Right.
And those people to me are identical to the the so-called Islamo-fascists that run Iran, the Basij, the religious zealots that go out there and slash at women who show too much leg or too much face. That kind of mentality is an extreme version of it. But in the American context, they seem to be these sort of white, middle American men who seem to be sort of enraptured and insulated in their zeal. They are, I think, crusaders, but the truth of the matter is they're getting a moral free ride because they can be incredibly righteous. And of course, who's not against killing babies? But once these babies are born, they've taken away the money for them, which they're doing now in the house. And right. And then once they're born, they're someone else's problem.
That's right. Well, it's not only that the children become, essentially, it's not that the children become uncared for, it's that the women have always been uncared for. And when you see something like the members of Congress who are deeply opposed to abortion, who then say we're going to cut off all the family planning money, you begin to see that it's not about, a love of fetal life or a love of or respect for life itself. It's about some kind of strange rage towards women themselves and towards women's control of their fertility. You know, you end up really thinking, in psychological terms, that there is this enormous envy on the part of people, of part of men, but also, you know, women are involved in this too, but on the part of many men, for the fact that women are the ones who reproduce, that we're the ones who have babies, and the fact that we control when, how, and whether we bring children into the world just simply is absolutely impossible emotionally for men to accept. I mean, when you realize that the one of the largest causes of maternal death in the United States is men who kill their partners during pregnancy, you realize that you really are dealing with, you know, fundamentalist rage that's almost impossible to fathom, for normal people to fathom.
But it's not sanctified by God. It's not Christian. That's the part of it I don't understand. There's no mention of abortion in the Bible, but it seems to have taken on this dimension.
Yes, there is no mention of abortion. You're right. There's no mention of abortion in the Bible, but there's also in both the Bible and in other religious texts and the Quran. There is a lot of mention of controlling women.
Sure.
And certainly in most of early Christian texts, they're filled with the notion that it's woman's fault. You know, religiosity does fuel this. It's woman's fault that man fell.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today in Los Angeles, Frances Kissling. But thank you for joining us here on International Women's Day.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with feminist activist Frances Kissling. She was president of Catholics for Choice until her retirement in 2007. She's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And she writes a weekly blog for Salon.com and blogs for religiondispatches.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter, and associate producers, Erica Rivera and Samantha Sumong Pong. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I've also started a daily blog there. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog and let me know what you think. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.